This is Tripwire Week in Review for week ending October 21st, 2022. I'm Martha Kocher with Trep, a data modeling and analytics firm for the CMBS, commercial real estate and CLO markets. I'm with Manus Clancy, Senior Managing Director, and Lonnie Henry, Head of CRE and Advisory Services. This week, with political fallout in the UK from recent economic turmoil, here in the US, a solid start to the earnings season with a mixed bag from the big banks. In economic data, two regional surveys show manufacturing activity is struggling. In housing, multiple reports point to a continued slowdown. Housing starts dropped more than expected, including in multifamily. New loan activity dropped to a 25-year low, and home builder sentiment fell for the 10th month in a row. And Manus, we saw the 10-year yield hit its highest level since 2008.
This was a rough week in data, but not a bad week for the markets. It was quite counterintuitive. I kind of feel like we're back to early June or late July, where there was this optimism that we had seen peak inflation, that we had seen the conditions ripen for a Fed pivot and so forth. So what do I mean by that? Well, Monday and Tuesday, we saw huge stock market rallies. On Wednesday and Thursday, even though Treasury yields were really, really surging, we're up on the 10-year 30 basis points for the week. Stocks only gave back modest amounts of those Monday and Tuesday gains. So the resilience of the market, I think, is the big surprise this week. Whether this is just kind of another false start like we saw in June and July, or whether this is the start of something bigger because the Fed is ready to pivot, or because we're going to get better inflation numbers as the year goes on, I don't really know. My gut tells me that this could be another false start. Why do I say that? I say that because today's data, when you look beyond the earnings, the Philadelphia manufacturing number, well, far more negative than had been anticipated. The Conference Board's leading economic indicator number, slightly worse than anticipated. And then after hours on the earnings front, Snap missed and is now down 25%. So, but all in all, I do think the headline is bond investors and stock investors see this market in two different lights. Bond investors just keep pushing yields higher and spreads higher because we did see CMBS widen the last couple of days. And stock investors, the equity markets, see the glasses half full. I'm not sure I'm with the stock investors at this point.
Yeah, so I'll pick up a little bit there, Manus, where you said, you know, not a great week from the data perspective. We have a lot of numbers here, a lot of survey results, and that tells a pretty bleak story. So if you look at two of the regional surveys that measure manufacturing, it shows that they're struggling with declining orders, thinning backlogs, and right-sizing of customer inventories. Chief economist from Regions Financial Corp, Richard Moody, effectively said, you know, this is really bad news for the industry. The New York Fed's Empire State Business Conditions Index, say that five times fast, which is a gauge of manufacturing activity in the state, fell 7.6 points to a negative 9.1 in October. Anything above zero indicates deteriorating conditions. So not great news on the manufacturing front. Martha teased on the lead-in, some of the residential, you know, home builder, home buyer sentiment. So I'll give you some of the stats there. The home builder sentiment index fell for the record 10th month in a row in October. National Association of Home Builders monthly confidence fell 8 points to 38 in October. If you look at the same data a year ago, the index was at 80. 10-month drop is a new record. And, you know, it's fallen 8 months straight in 2006 to 2007. And so, you know, we're kind of in uncharted territory at this point. It's the 10th month in a row the index has fallen. The situation is unhealthy and unsustainable. That's according to a home builder and NAHB chairman from Savannah, Georgia. If you look at existing home sales, they fell to a 10-year low in September. Sales of previously owned homes fell 1.5% from September to August. So, I mean, just not great news. New loan activity, it seems like every week I give a little anecdote on this, but they slowed even further last week. MBA, Mortgage Bankers Association Market Composite Index, effectively said it decreased 4.5% on a seasonally adjusted basis. And the 30-year fixed rate mortgage was somewhere between 6.94. I even saw some stuff today that showed it above 7%. So, you know, really daunting times there. We did have some earnings this week. So the banks started reporting. JP Morgan reported a 17% drop in third quarter profit, although that was less than what was feared. Wells Fargo posted a 31% decline, and Citi reported a 25% drop. Interestingly, Wells Fargo is the only one to this point that's cut the size of its staff. It looks like on the year, they're down about 5.8% in terms of headcount. So, you know, to your point, the data doesn't paint a great picture, but it seems like the market has still been resilient. Sometimes the headlines don't translate, but if you look at this data on its face, logic would say these are not great indicators.
Going back to the rate thing, the 7 handle on mortgages, I think that's where we are. And I think that's where we are on not just resi. We're probably there for certain property types on commercial. The 10-year rate was up 58 basis points from the beginning of October to today. The 2-year is up about 75 basis points. So you have two different impacts, right? The cost of refinancing a balloon loan that is going from either fixed to fixed or fixed to floating is probably out of the money right now, meaning it's a cash-in refi in many cases. We've talked about that a lot before. The other side of the coin is, and this was a very well-received discussion last week. In fact, we had a couple of listeners come out to us and we did some seminars on interest rate caps this week. Thank you for reaching out, by the way. And it was nice to meet some of you new listeners. But those caps got substantially more expensive this week, right? Just today, the 1-month treasury is up 27 basis points, right? So every day, these borrowers have been waiting to, you know, line up this interest rate cap. That cost just keeps it going up and up and up. And that's really been the case every day in October. And that will certainly chill the market, right? It's going to chill it certainly on the CRE CLO lending side as this becomes a much more expensive endeavor. And it's going to lead to some sticker shock for those that go out and get loans quoted to them on refinancing. You know, it's a tricky time for borrowers.
It'll be interesting, Manus, to see how quickly we actually start seeing at scale the impacts of those rates. I mean, we've talked about them the last month or two. We're starting to see maybe some indications of repricing. But if you look at the whole, I don't think we've felt the effects of that. So I don't know, you know, if that's a 6-month process, is that a 12-month process for the system to actually start digesting those things? I mean, obviously, sales transaction volumes have slowed and they're going to continue to slow, in my opinion. I would assume it's probably tied to some of the maturities and the, you know, the rolling of these loans that where we're really going to start to feel the impact. Because at that point, either the lender is going to extend and pretend, or if they don't, the borrowers aren't going to have the ability to just continue to service the property. They're going to have to either sell at a discount, you know, raise additional capital or bring, you know, to bring money to the table for a cash in refinance or whatever. But I don't know, maybe your Martha has some thoughts on, you know, what you think that looks like timing wise relative to the interest rate, because it's been so quick how fast they've gone from historic lows to now, to your point, almost 7% in some cases.
You know, my response would be, and this is enormously unscientific, you know, we do read tons and tons of literature every single day from newspapers around the country, and we try to parse through it all in preparation for the pod. It does feel, without a doubt, that the pace at which transactions are taking place has slowed very sharply. It's not zero, but it feels like 40% of what it was at its peak 6 months ago, something like that. And it's very rare now to see that story which says this property sold for 75% more than what it sold for in 2019, right? We do see things where it's 25% higher, 30% higher, things like that. But that shocking headline, which is 100% return over 36 months, that's becoming rarer and rarer. And again, not scientific, just kind of a gut feel on my part.
So the last few weeks, we've talked about digging for data and our insights dashboard. And if you recall, a few weeks ago, we looked at loans that were in our database that were maturing over the next 24 months and their DSCR was below 1.25. We're actually going to broaden the lens a little bit and look at all maturing loans in the next 24 months and get a sense for where potential stress may be.
Yeah, so we had some really good inbound traffic that came in from that anecdote on the pod a few weeks ago. And we actually had an email this last week that talked about, we should potentially look at debt yield in addition to just debt service coverage ratio. So I think that's a valid point. Today, what I'm going to try to articulate is, what does the holistic market that we track look like? If you don't take into consideration debt yield or debt service coverage ratio as, you know, a restriction on the subset of properties, what does the universe look like that are going to mature within the next 24 months from now? And I've included properties that are, you know, current on the mortgage, 30 days delinquent or 60 days delinquent. So we haven't included the REO properties or, you know, properties that are performing past maturity, et cetera. In this example, we're looking at about $300 billion worth of upcoming loans. So I think where this gets really interesting, and it's broken down, you know, multifamily leads the pack both in total properties and outstanding loan balance. Office is second with outstanding loan balance. Office is about $59 billion. Multi is about $82.5 billion. Lodging is the third largest with about $48 billion. It actually has more properties than office does, but office has a higher balance per property. And then all the way down to, you know, some of these alternative asset classes. But what's interesting here is to do some deeper dive analysis, our research team over the next couple of weeks is going to start looking at these upcoming maturities and putting some stressors on them based on looking at their in-place interest rates and what those loans look like under the new prevailing interest rates. And so, you know, $300 billion is nothing to sneeze at. I'm assuming at this point, without having dug into the data, that some of those, just by definition of the new interest rate environment, are going to be distressed, even though at this point they're still current on the mortgage or don't show any distress, even by debt yield or DSCR metric. So more to come on this, but sizable, $52 billion of what we consider, you know, potentially distressed at that less than 125 DSCR, almost $300 billion total in terms of upcoming maturity. So I think that actually goes back a little bit to my previous question of, you know, when do we start seeing these things play out? And I think if you look at $300 billion over the next 24 months, we're going to have a lot better picture of, are these assets going to be able to find a way? Are lenders going to work with borrowers? Are the borrowers going to come to the table and bring additional cash when needed to refinance these notes?
Well, as you were speaking, Lonnie, I just jumped into the Treasury website, which keeps track of yields every day going back, you know, a couple decades. And from my scanning of it, it looked like the average Treasury, the average 10-year Treasury in 2012 was somewhere between 1.75 and 2%. So if we're at 4.25 now, you're talking about, on the basis of just Treasury move alone, let's assume spreads are similar to where they were then. I don't know if they are or not, but let's assume that they are. You're talking about a 250 basis point, 225 basis point uptick in rate for that property. Maybe some of that is offset by revenue growth over the last 10 years and you come out whole on the refinancing side, right, on the proceeds side, but maybe not. If you're flat, like at a mall or an older office, you may not be so fortunate. 5 years ago, for those guys, those borrowers that took out five-year debt, it was about 240, 245, 250 was the average rate in 2017. So even there, you're talking about 175 basis points in additional debt service costs than 5 years ago. So it's not an insubstantial amount at the moment.
So moving on to office, we have a theme, and it is, pick your adjective, a litany, a laundry list, a plethora, a potpourri of subleases and givebacks.
Yeah, I felt like for a long time, the sublease story was very much a San Francisco, Chicago, and to a lesser extent, New York story. And I feel like in the last month or so, it has evolved to something, you know, much more widespread. And I'm going to run through a couple of stories that we saw this week. They're not positive stories. You know, at some point in the future, what we'll try to do is kind of isolate some of these markets and paint a picture for you of, you know, what other properties are around these particular ones we're going to mention today that could be impacted by these subleases that are being made available. Maybe that's a future digging in the data segment. But in the Seattle MSA, Microsoft is going to let more than 1 million square feet of space expire without renewal. That comes from Alex Halverson of the Puget Sound Business Journal. They were known to be downsizing and letting leases expire at a couple of properties. They've now kind of doubled that amount and the number of properties that they're giving back. So that's a really dramatic move for Microsoft. A lot of these spaces come due in 2023 and 2024, and that will weigh on that market in the near term. And I say Seattle MSA, Microsoft is primarily in Bellevue. In Boston, the Boston Business Journal was reporting that Reebok has put its entire office in the Seaport District up for sublease. The office there, almost 200,000 square feet across five floors. I think that's fairly new construction. And if I were to guess, that was really purpose-built for Reebok. That might not be the easiest thing to convert to lab space very quickly, should that be the case. In Columbus, Ohio, Cardinal Health has put 400,000 square feet of office space up at 5100 Rings Road. This is from Bonnie Mibers of the Columbus Biz First. Cardinal is going to move 2,000 workers, I guess, to permanent work from home. They only moved there in 2018, so this is a negative story for that Columbus market. In San Francisco, Facebook is putting out space for sublet at 181 Fremont Street. That does back a CMBS loan. I think we touched upon that last week. In Boston, again, General Electric is planning to leave its Fort Point headquarters next year. They had moved there from Connecticut a couple of years ago with a lot of fanfare. I think it was a real kick in the shins to Connecticut. You know, GE was a real big employer there. They went to Boston with a lot of fanfare. They expected to move thousands of employees into that Boston market. They currently have 100,000 square feet, and that's going to be vacated. And then lastly, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and this comes from Kelly Boucher of the Minneapolis St. Paul Biz Journal, United Health has put one of its Minnetonka offices up for sublease, 150,000 square feet on Whitewater Drive. Why does this one, to me, seem so alarming? Well, this is the third story of its kind in the Minneapolis suburbs of a firm putting up more than 100,000 square feet for sublease. When you add them all together, it's between 600 and 800,000 square feet. One was Optum, which I think was 450,000 square feet, now United Health, and there was a third one, which I can't recall. And on top of that, you have Target moving out of downtown. So if there's a market that really, really worries me right now, it is that Minneapolis-St. Paul market, just because this is hitting that market very quickly and with a lot of size.
And just before we move on, I need to correct myself. I said adjective. I know they're nouns. So before I get 10 emails from Grammarly's, just want to point that out.
Well, you know, let me tell you, Martha, as somebody that barely speaks English and, you know, have malaprops week after week after week and mispronunciations, you can only count on three or four corrections. You know, it won't be a tidal wave.
That's all right.
Yeah, I was going to say Norman the Noun was going to come after you on that one, for those that don't remember.
I remember.
I was on the watch. Really interesting, Manus. I know we had kind of made a call out to our listeners a couple of weeks ago to say, you know, when does a market transition from being a, you know, market rental rate, market lease environment to a sublease market? And I think what you just walked through in Minnesota, Minneapolis market specifically, you know, they have to be making that transition over to a fully sublease space. And my gut tells me that in that instance, all of the lease renewals that are turning over at this point, I mean, have to be at substantially less than what they were before. And so this is definitely a slippery slope for those markets. And to your point, it's not just San Francisco. I mean, Seattle, these are some pretty hefty office markets across the US. So, you know, I think that goes back to, are we going to start seeing greatly reduced sales prices? Are we going to start seeing investors come in and maybe take a bet on some of these things? Or are we going to see them start to sit there and, you know, maybe these reposition ideas that we've tossed around, you know, people are going to start trying to put those into practice?
So a couple more stories we'll go through. They're not, we will get to a couple of green shoots that we'll mention at the end. Not everything is crabgrass, but a couple of other things to keep your eye on. This comes from Lois Weiss of The Real Deal. Lois and the Trepp team go way back to her days at the New York Post, and really dedicated and deeply knowledgeable reporter on the New York / Manhattan office space. She reported this week that in Lower Manhattan, American Express has engaged Cushman and Wakefield to help it with its spatial needs. American Express has a huge amount of space at 200 VC Street in kind of the Lower West Side Financial District area. That building has 2.1 million square feet, and American Express is looking to either downsize enormously in New York or even move to cheaper locations elsewhere. So that is, you know, a sizable chunk of space in that part of the market, which could weigh on it going forward.
Was that a broker's start your engine segment?
That could be. You know, it's certainly for the leasing broker, because it sounds like American Express is keen on finding new digs. So by all means, whether Brookfield will look to move the property or how they'll deal with the potential vacancy, hard to know. But yes, the leasing brokers definitely rev up.
I think the challenge now is they're no longer driving a V8. They can't afford the gas, and they're down to a four cylinder. So that rev might be a little less intimidating at this point.
Okay, yes. Golf cart.
Yeah, it could be one of those things where they go from taking their clients around in a nice, you know, dark leather seated SUV, you know, a Suburban, to maybe getting those guys, what do they call them? Pedicabs, right? Everybody hop in. We got to get the bike guy to pull us around. We're going to go, you know, don't worry about him. He's a young and in good shape. He can get us from Wall Street to Grand Central in no time. A couple of other crabgrassy stories. This one out in California, Juul, the guys that make the, what do you call them? Fake cigarettes? Inhalables? I don't know. What is
No, fake cigarettes were the things we had as kids. Remember those little pink things that you blew the powder out of and then you chewed it? They were gum. No, these are, I think, electronic.
Well, I'm going to pivot, you know, very quickly. You know, Halloween is coming up now. And whenever we're in a recession with Halloween coming, you know, the quality of candy you get really kind of spirals lower. And it just reminds me of those years when things were kind of dicey during the 70s and people would hand out the fake cigarettes, the white things with the red tips.
That's what I'm talking about.
They were just
about.
Like kind of pressed, and they would come in a cigarette box, like Newports.
Of course. Right?
Newport candy cigarettes. So hopefully we don't downgrade that much. But truth be told, I would take those above a Clark bar in no time. Right?
They were gum.
Yeah. Anyway, Juul in San Francisco, they're going to try to sell their 400,000 square foot office at 123 Mission Street. Why did this one catch my attention? Well, Juul paid $400 million for this, more than $1,000 a square foot in 2019. Last year, it wanted to sell it. It was offering the building at $450 million, didn't sell. The writer for this, which was, I don't know, next week I'll come back to you with that, has told us that the market for that building right now is $174 million. So you're talking about a $220 million discount, about 55% of the value that it sold for in 2019. And if that number is right, and it's kind of rumored, it's broker talk, but if that's true, that is a shockingly low number for that San Francisco market. Lonnie, Martha, what do you think?
I think that would set some precedents heading into the San Francisco, you know, office transition. I mean, we've been talking about it for the last year or so on the upside, where every week on the pod, we'd have record-breaking sales price on the good. This could maybe kick off some of that on the downside. And so it'll be interesting. I mean, I think San Francisco, you know, is going to make a good case study, because the underlying fundamentals there for so long have been so good that they've attracted all of this top talent, all these major corporations, credit-worthy tenants, you know, namesake type of buildings. And with everything that's going on there outside of just, you know, the macroeconomics, just local politics, it'll be interesting to see if they can survive this. I mean, I think for some people that are well capitalized, they can make that bet and maybe sit on it for a while until things turn around there. They're probably going to come out really good, but I don't think this is something where we're talking about a 24-month turnaround and somehow San Francisco comes roaring back. I think there's some broader challenges that have to be dealt with there, and it's probably going to take some time. and there's just a huge gluttony of office space. So it'll be interesting to see where that bottom actually is. But this would be a pretty good indication of the tide actually turning there.
Well, if I could take a moment to give a plug for an upcoming guest pod, we talked to Tony Youssef, who is the director of national accounts at SVN. So he spends his time overseeing the management and disposition of assets. And his experiences at San Francisco has some real challenges similar to New York, and specifically things that, you know, go just beyond economics, but things that involve politics as well. So it may take some time for that city to turn around.
That was one of our best guest interviews. We've had a lot of really good ones, a lot of good guests. But Tony was really quite knowledgeable. And because he covers so many markets, really covered a lot of ground. I'm looking forward to hearing what our listeners think about that one, because we thought that was quite meaty and quite timely. Going back to Jewel for just a minute, that story was Laura Waxman of the San Francisco Business Times. Two more stories kind of a similar ilk. In Chicago, Manulife has hired a broker to try to help them sell 200 South Wacker. That's a 760,000 square foot office. Why did this one catch my attention? Again, quoting sources that know this market, and it was quoted in the article I was reading, Real Estate Alert, the value could go for $170 million, which would be down from $215 million when Manulife bought the property in 2013. And then lastly, we'll call this one mixed green, some good and some bad from it. Rich Bachman of The Real Deal had this one. Veris Residential, which is the successor to Mac Cali Realty, has sold $766 million worth of properties in Jersey City. Three of them are in that Harborside project, Harborside 1, 2, and 3. Those things went for about $420 million. That's a nice green shoot. A lot of banking clients, Merrill Lynch and so forth, are in that area. So a nice price there. The crabgrassy part of the mixed green there is that part of the sale included 101 Hudson, which sold for $346 million. This deal has been in the works for a while. It was valued at $482 million, the property was, in 2016. It was under contract to sell for $380 million in 2021. And according to Mr. Bachman, sold for $346 million. So about, you know, let's call it a one-third discount to the value of where we were in 2016. So just a lot of bad things. We do have some other things that are better, but, you know, clearly the tone of the market for office has tilted bearish and concerning.
But we did see some positive news. So let's cover a couple positive stories. The Wells Fargo story coming out of Dallas is kind of a follow-up to something that we talked about maybe a few weeks ago. We were speculating about what was going on there.
Yeah, so they've announced Wells Fargo is officially building a new campus in Irving, Texas, just outside of Dallas. So they haven't said that this is going to be a relocation of their headquarters. In fact, back in June, they said they have no plans to move their headquarters. But if you look at what they're building here, it begs the question. They've significantly downsized their footprint in San Francisco. So Governor Greg Abbott's office confirmed construction. It's going to be a multi-tower regional corporate campus just outside Dallas, as I mentioned. A couple of good things here is the construction and the building is supposed to create 650 new jobs and is going to be about $455 million in new capital from Wells Fargo to construct the facility. They are getting from the Texas Enterprise Fund about $5 million from the state as part of their, you know, enticements to lure new office tenants to the state. So that's one thing that maybe doesn't get as much publicity as it potentially could or should, but Texas has been very aggressive in targeting these larger corporate relocations, and they're happy to give out, you know, tax abatements or enterprise fund grants or whatever if the business moving here can create new jobs and commit to being here for some period of time. So in this case, you know, $5 million as part of a $455 million construction project is not much, but it certainly is something that probably helped with some of that decision-making on the Wells Fargo side.
Yeah, I don't think California's out of the woods with this one. You know, we've talked in the past about Wells downsizing and giving back space in San Francisco. And sometimes these types of moves are a precursor to a headquarters move. And sometimes they keep the headquarters, but kind of in name only, right? They reduce the headcount by 75% and they still have a major physical place where they could bring in clients and so forth and make business and so forth. But, you know, a lot of the workforce moves to a new location. And, you know, that would be a real big blow to San Francisco that has taken a lot of blows over the last couple of weeks with Facebook and others downsizing in big numbers. We will get to a couple of green shoots, but, you know, maybe I'll throw this out. You know, I told Lonnie I'd throw him a couple of knuckleballs this week. So here comes one. You know, for the last 5 years, you know, the marginal taker of space, right? The mega consumer of office space has been those FANG guys, right? Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, Google. And now we're starting to see the change of the flow, right? The water's emptying out of the bathtub, not going into the bathtub. You know, do you have any logical things that might impact that demand, right? Who could fill that gap going forward that has been filled so nicely for 5 years?
Well, yeah, I don't have an answer to who could fill that, but I would say, you know, we actually talked about this probably about 9 or 10 months ago. I had given some examples about Austin, where they had this huge influx of, you know, Indeed, Facebook, you know, now Meta, Apple, millions and millions of square feet in a fairly small, geographically, you know, proximate office market. And it's great on the upside where people come in and sign a 10 or 15 or 20 year lease, take down a whole building, and it looks great and it sounds great. And it is great until they decide to start leaving, downsizing, subleasing, et cetera. And I know the leases are guaranteed in most cases, but to your point, a lot of those things are not going to be backfilled. I mean, if you look at the number of tenants in an average office lease with the square footage requirements that they have, a lot of these buildings are going to take, you know, some multiple of tenants to try to backfill that space. And you look at all the factors that are impacting office right now, I just don't see in a lot of these markets that have become kind of specialized, you know, quasi tech hubs. So when people started leaving San Francisco and they started going to Austin as an example, you know, kind of got the moniker Silicon Hills for the hill country down in Austin. And those people start to leave like they are now, it's going to be really tough for them to backfill that space. So I think it adds another layer of complexity to the office market. What you hope is that they downsize or they put the space up for sublease, and, you know, maybe before it gets leased out that they reverse and come back to the office, or they find some other use at a company level where Facebook, you know, fills the space with some other use or utility or acquisition or whatever the case may be to fill that space. But I think there's a lot of these mid-size, you know, not totally secondary, certainly not tertiary markets, but kind of the 1A where they got this huge influx of really great long-term lease. We saw at the onset of COVID, if you were a retail center owner and you had a Starbucks, you loved having Starbucks in your center until COVID hit. And then they came in and demanded that they get rent reductions at 50% or something for the next 12 months. And while your mom and pop tenants are in there trying to do whatever they can to stay afloat. So creditworthiness, credit tenants are great until they're not. And I think we're starting to see some of that play out in the office space. I wish we had an answer, but I think it's a complex challenge.
So let me put you into the crystal ball world, right? Let's fast forward 5 years from now, and I gave you three scenarios. Let me know which one you think is the most likely to play out, right? Let's just take it as a given that we have a lot of vacancy over the next 3 years that has to be filled. Most likely thing that comes out, the biggest surprise, conversion to multifamily for big numbers, conversion to life science space, or the market is more resilient than we think, and these things get leased up and they muddle through. If you had to pick one of those for a five-year prediction, where would you go?
So I'm actually going to go with option three. I think the market will revert to the mean. I think people will eventually come back to the office. I think we'll definitely have a trimming of some of the older, functionally obsolete office buildings. But I think generally speaking, there's not a good alternative use for a lot of these buildings. Like the cost to convert something from an office that's got functional obsolescence as an office, it's not like you just manually go in quickly and convert that to a functional apartment or multifamily or whatever mixed use. there's extreme cost involved. A lot of those B and C office buildings are going to have other environmental and other issues to go through the conversion process anyway. So, you know, I think what we're going to have is maybe a prolonged period of kind of distress. And as you mentioned, man, it's kind of like just purgatory of those assets sitting there, and maybe stabilized occupancy in some of those markets for some of those buildings become 70%. And you just kind of muddle through. And then I think hopefully on the backside, they come back and maybe there's a lower rung of rental rates that make those offices viable and can fill them back up. But what, for all the talk of the conversions, we haven't seen any of them. It's really hard to execute. And I think the thing that makes me more bearish on that now is we're starting to see cracks in the multifamily demand side, and we're starting to see cracks in traditional multi. So what would make you think that converting an old antiquated office to multi, that there's even going to be strong enough demand on that side for that to be absorbed? I think if I'm an apartment developer, I'm not buying an old office building and sinking millions and millions of dollars into a conversion when the overall multifamily landscape has shifted the way it has over the last, call it, 6 months or so.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether that conversion trend ever really happens. We've heard many anecdotes of it, and we've reported on. In fact, we just saw a story this week that Harley Davidson, who had left their office in 2020, says they're going to repurpose that headquarters for something else. They haven't yet revealed what that's going to be. So that might be interesting to see what they do with that. But we hear many stories of properties that are repositioned or marketed to be repositioned for something else, like multifamily. To quote our contact, Tony Youssef again, he says he has yet to see one of these happen. So for all the talk and the marketing, it'll be interesting to see how much of this actually comes to fruition.
Well, we did promise you green shoots, and Lonnie gave us a modest green shoot. He says we're going to muddle through, right? Which is certainly better than not muddling through, for sure. So, and I kind of agree with you, Lonnie. I think that, you know, when we get to these moments where we all think the worst is going to happen, it doesn't usually play out as badly as the most dire predictions would suggest. And I think that's true. But I do think it will vary by geography. Going through two other green shoots here. This one's from the Commercial Observer. Metadata Solutions, they have a huge swath of space at 350 Hudson Street. This is kind of, again, lower west side-y thing, kind of by Citibank's headquarters. They have renewed for 177,000 square feet. So that's great news for that market. And in Midtown Manhattan, MGM Studios has signed for 50,000 square feet at 260 Madison Avenue. Why did that one catch my eye? Well, two reasons. One is, I believe Coca-Cola was planning to leave that office, and MGM will backfill that particular space. And then secondarily, this backs a pretty sizable CMBS loan that missed its maturity date. So getting this new lease in place may help them get over the finish line in terms of getting refinancing. So a couple of green shoots there. Wish we had more.
Turning to retail, we have a couple of stories to hit there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the theme here is, and I know we're getting late in the broadcast, I think the good news there's a lot more green shoots this week in the retail space than in office. The green shoots came in the form of loans paying off that were big 2012 mall loans. Concord Mills was one of them. There was a second one that paid off. Both were like multiple tens of millions of dollars worth of maturing loans, and both of those paid off. Elsewhere, we had one in Boston, a big loan that paid off that we'll write about on Monday. In St. Petersburg, we saw a mall sell for above the balance of the outstanding asset. This is an REO asset that was worth, has a $70 million outstanding balance. The sale price of the property was $85 million, so a much bigger recovery than anticipated for that particular asset. That's all I got.
Yeah, so it's good to hear some of that, you know, fairly positive retail news, Manus. We did have one last office story that I wanted to throw in. Lululemon signed about a 37,000 square foot lease to take the fourth floor and part of the third floor in an office building in Santa Monica. It's according to the Commercial Observer. Interesting nugget from that piece was that they quantified the amount of sublease space in the greater LA market. They said it was up 17% to a total of about 9.6 million square feet over the past year. That was according to Saville's third quarter office report. So, you know, we talked a lot today about sublease space. That gives us a little approximation relative to the LA market in terms of what that's done year over year and what that total available sublease space looks like.
And just to close the loop, I left the one story out. Concord Mills was one of the loans that paid off $235 million. That was Concord, North Carolina. And in Jersey City, the Newport Center loan, $141 million loan, also was retired this week. Both of those loans were rolled into new CMBS. So, on the retail side, the theme, more green shoots, more positives than negatives. We could take that out of this week's podcast. And the fact that they got new financing out of CMBS is a sign that, you know, the market has not closed down. There's still lending going on. People are getting financing, and we're not at the 2008 ice age for those that are concerned that lending has shut down. Certainly hasn't at this point.
Shout outs. First, John B. had some comments. He had a lot to say, liked our podcast, and had some questions that we answered. Ann L. had some hotel closures information. Emily D., Tony Youssef, and our guy Watson. Look out for the guest episode that's going to drop sometime next week. Dan M., who's our loyal podcast freelancer. We missed him in the office this week. He was visiting, but he's always good for a steady stream of guest recommendations. So thank you, Jeffrey C., interested in our cap rate information. Andrea S. gave a very kind shout out to me. And in fact, it was probably one of the nicest things someone has said about me. She said she loved some of my thoughts and observations and the fact that I can keep Manus and Lonnie on topic, which honestly, I'm not sure I do that. It's challenging. And then on Twitter, Shlomo C., Markets Junkie, Morgan W., he said, for those in the CRE industry, highly recommends our podcast, our data-filled content, and it's useful for everyone in CRE. And they drop a obscure basketball and ban reference occasionally. Yeah, we're overdue for some ban references, I think.
Yes, we need to get Oz back on and having some walk-up music, you know, before we come on. You know, something like the batters do before a baseball game. You know, you walk up to the plate and they're playing a Street Fighting Man or something like that by the Rolling Stones. You know, I could go for that.
Yeah, I'm hoping if we ever do a live recording somewhere, we have a smoke machine we can come out to with like those low high fives like the basketball players do and then a chest bump on stage or something.
Yeah, my walk-up music would be Gimme Shelter. It has like a slight attachment to commercial real estate and it's one of the greatest songs of all time.
It is true. That is true. And just a couple more thoughts for you guys. There were a couple studies published this week that revealed what Americans may have been doing with their extra time as a result of not having to commute as much since we're all working from home on several days. Well, apparently more leisure activity. And interestingly, there was another study that suggested that work from home may have contributed to a reversal in the birth rate decline.
Well, that's good to see, right? I think that we've talked about in this country a long time, the Social Security going closer and closer to insolvency. We need that birth rate to be, you know, stable and growing. And I suppose that's a green shoot too. So good news for the country.
With that, we'll close. Thanks to our producer, Haley Keene. Join us next week as we look at what's happened during the week and how it may be impacting you. If you have a question or comment, send your email to podcast@trepp.com. And subscribe to the podcast with your favorite provider. Thank you for listening and stay well.
All right.